in the Far East. Dealers expressed concern that the stream of sexual scandal enveloping the royal family could cause a full-blown constitutional and political crisis, following the resignation of the King's press secretary last week and lurid photographs of Princess Charlotte published in many of this morning's newspapers. The Bank of England and other European banks moved to support sterling as soon as the markets opened, but could not prevent further speculative selling, driving the currency down hard against the bottom of its EC limits. There were reports of a major holder of sterling in the Far East dumping significant quantities of the currency. It is feared that interest rates may have to be raised substantially to prop up the ailing pound. "This sort of situation is a new one for us," one dealer commented. "The markets hate the uncertainty. At times this morning they were in turmoil. The sheikhs are saying, if Buckingham Palace crumbles, how safe is the Bank of England? The city has the atmosphere of a farmyard before Christmas." Chapter 43. Damn his stubbornness. If I crucified him, he would only expect to rise again on the third day. It was a good day for a hanging, MacKillan thought. The chamber was packed beyond capacity, with many members, deprived of a seat on the benches, standing at the bar, crouching in gangways or crowding around the sides of the speaker's chair. The pressure of so many mostly male bodies crushed together gave rise to a heady, boisterous atmosphere, overflowing with expectation. It was said there had been similar scenes at Tyburn when they came to hang some wretch from the three-legged gallows, and that they even paid for the privilege of watching the poor bastard swing. There had already been a long queue of victims today. The waves of panic rippling through the currency markets had washed over into the stock exchange, and by lunchtime share prices were off, badly. The cries of pain emanating from those with exposed positions could be heard from all over the city, and it was going to spread faster than a lassie's legs at the Edinburgh Festival. The building societies were meeting in emergency session. Mortgages would have to be raised. The only question was by how much. It wasn't the King's fault, of course, but people had lost their innocent belief in bad fortune, in catastrophes simply happening. They had to have someone to blame. And that meant that MacKillan, too, was in the firing line, reflecting ruefully on his recent public displays of indulgence on behalf of the royal family, wincing at 100%. He had thought all morning of defence through aggression, making a full-scale charge in support of the King, but decided that the King's position was too well covered by hostile guns. The troops behind him were no light brigade, and he wasn't Errol Flynn. No point in getting shot in the Trossachs for nothing, much better to fight another day. Some question about human rights, perhaps, high-ground stuff related to the PM's lightning trip to Moscow, which had been announced for the coming week. That would do, give him some distance from the sound of battle, get him out from under the gibbet. As he waited, he began to feel sticky with the heat and pressure from the bodies of overfed men crowding around. He saw Urquhart appear just in time for the 3:15 PM start, forcing his way through the scrum which surrounded the speaker's chair, and squeezing past the outstretched limbs of other cabinet ministers perched untidily along the front bench. Urquhart smiled across the dispatch box at MacKillan, a fleeting parting of thin lips to expose the incisors, the first warning shot of the afternoon's campaign. Behind Urquhart's position sat the Honourable Lady Member for Dorset North, bobbing obsequiously as her master took his seat, wearing a garishly crimson outfit which stood out like a traffic beacon amidst the gloom of grey suits, and which would show well on the television screens. She had been practising her expressions of support all morning in front of a mirror. She was a handsome and well-presented woman, early 40s, with a voice like a hyena, which rumour had it could reach top C in bed, as even some members of the opposition claimed to know. She'd never make ministerial office, but her memoirs would probably outsell the rest. MacKillan leaned back, giving the impression of a relaxed demeanour while he studied the press gallery above his head. Over the finely carved balustrade he could see the heads of the scribblers, faces strained in expectation, their pencils and prejudices sharpened. He wouldn't keep them waiting. He would get in there at the first opportunity, show his colours and retire from the field before the real battle started and it all got out of control. Human rights, that was it. Damned good idea. Already Madam Speaker had called the first question, to ask the Prime Minister his engagements for the day, and Urquhart was giving his standard and calculatedly unhelpful response, detailing a few of his official appointments in addition to answering questions in the house. It'd be the first bloody time. It was the Beast from his seat below the gangway, which he claimed by right of constant occupation. He looked dyspeptic. Perhaps his sandwiches and pint of bitter had disagreed with him. Urquhart gave short shrift to the first question about a local bypass posed by a conscientious constituency member with a small majority, and it was McKillen's opportunity. He leaned forward and inclined his head towards Madam Speaker. "The Leader of the Opposition," Madam Speaker's voice summoned him to the dispatch box. He hadn't even finished rising to his feet before another voice cut through the bustle. "You couldn't mistake him for a Leader of the Opposition, the grovelling little shit." McKillen felt his cheeks flush with anger, then astonishment. It was the Beast, his own side. "Order, order," trilled Madam Speaker. In an atmosphere charged like this, with so many hot MPs rubbing shoulders and jostling elbows, she knew it was vital to stamp her authority on proceedings from the first moment of disruption. "I heard that. The Honourable Member will withdraw that remark immediately." "What else would you call someone who throws away all his principles and got caught licking the boots of the royal family? He's made a complete balls of it." Opposition members sat largely silent, stunned. Government backbenchers, too, were uncertain, not knowing whether to agree with the Beast or to denounce his vulgarity, but knowing it was essential to make as much noise as possible and stir the pot. In the midst of the growing uproar, the Beast, his tangled forelock tumbling across his face and his baggy sports jacket unbuttoned and open, was on his feet and ignoring the repeated demands of Madam Speaker.
"But isn't it an undeniable fact?"
"No more!"
shrieked the Speaker, her half-moon glasses slipping down her nose as she flushed uncomfortably hot beneath her wig.
"I shall have no hesitation in naming the Honourable Member unless he withdraws his remarks immediately."
"But
withdraw!"
Cries demanding his retraction grew from all sides. The sergeant-at-arms, the parliamentary constable, dressed for the part in executioner's garb of black cloth court dress, complete with silk stockings and ceremonial sword, was standing to attention at the bar, waiting on Madam Speaker's instructions.
"But,"
began the Beast once again,
"withdraw!"
There was pandemonium. The Beast looked around, seeming unperturbed, as if he could hear none of the noise nor see the flailing hands and order papers. He smiled, then at last seemed to appreciate that his game was up, for he started nodding his head in agreement. The din subsided, allowing him to be heard.
"Okay," he looked towards the Speaker's chair. "Which words do you want me to withdraw? Grovelling, little, or shit?"
The tidal wave of outrage all but drowned Madam Speaker's cries.
"All of it! I want it all withdrawn!"
Eventually she was heard.
"The lot. You want me to withdraw the lot?" "Immediately!"
The wig had been shaken askew, and she was attempting to readjust herself, desperately struggling to maintain her temper and sense of dignity.
"All right, all right."
The Beast held up his hands to silence the tumult.
"You may all know my views about grovelling to their royal mightinesses, but..."
He stared around fiercely at the pack of parliamentary hounds snapping at his heels.
"If you rule I can't say such things that I've got to retract it, then I shall.
Now, this instant."
There was a baying of approval from all sides. The Beast was now pointing at McKillen.
"Yes, I was wrong. You obviously can mistake him for a Leader of the Opposition, the grovelling little shit."
In the cacophony of shouts from all sides, there was not the slightest chance for Madam Speaker to make herself heard, but the Beast didn't wait to be named, gathering up his papers from the floor and throwing a lingering look of insolence in the direction of his party leader before withdrawing himself from the chamber. The sergeant-at-arms, who could lip-read the Speaker's instructions, fell in beside the Beast to ensure he remained withdrawn from the premises of the Palace of Westminster for the next 5 working days. As the Beast's back passed through the doors and beyond, some semblance of order began to be restored to the chamber. From beneath her wig, still slightly askew, Madam Speaker gazed in the direction of McKillen, her eyes inquiring after his intentions. He shook his head. He didn't want any longer to ask some fool question about human rights. What about his own human rights? All he wanted was for this cruel and exceptional punishment to come to an end, for someone to come and gently cut him down from the parliamentary gallows on which he was swinging, and hoped they might give him a decent burial.
"How do you do it, Francis?"
Stamper demanded as he strode into the Prime Minister's office in the House of Commons.
"Do what?"
"Get the beast so wound up that on his own he's more effective at stuffing MacKillan than a dozen Barnsley butchers."
"My dear Tim, you've become such a sad old cynic. You look for conspiracies everywhere. The truth, if you could ever recognize it as such, is that I don't have to wind him up. He comes ready wound. No, my contribution to the fun is more along these lines."
He indicated the television with its display of the latest teletext news. The building societies had finished their emergency meeting, and the result of their deliberations was flashing up on the screen.
"Christ, 2% on mortgages? That'll go down like a shovel of shit in drinking water."
"Precisely. See how much concern the average punter has for the homeless when the mortgage on his own semi-detached roof starts burning its way through his beer money. By closing time tonight, the King's conscience will seem an irrelevant and unaffordable luxury."
"My apologies for ever having uttered a cynical remark in your presence."
"Accepted. Voters appreciate clear choices, Tim. It helps them concentrate. I am presenting them with a choice which is practically transparent. The King may be a rare orchid to my common cabbage, but when the buggers start starving, they'll grab for the cabbage every time."
"Enough cabbage to give the King chronic wind."
"My dear Tim, you might say that. On such matters, I couldn't possibly comment."
The King was seated before his television screen, where he had remained silently watching events since the televising of Prime Minister's Question Time had begun. He had left instructions not to be disturbed, but eventually his private secretary could restrain his sense of unease no longer. He knocked and entered with a deferential bow.
"Sir, my apologies, but you must know that we are being inundated with calls from the media, wanting some reaction, some guidance as to your feelings about events in the House of Commons. They will not take silence as an answer, and without a press officer—"
The King seemed not to have noticed the intrusion, staring fixedly at the screen, unblinking, his body taut, the veins at his temple a vivid blue against the parchment skin of his skull. He looked ashen, not with anger. The private secretary was well used to the flashes of fire which sparked from the King. The stillness suggested more a man on a different plane, driven deep within himself, the strain indicating that the search to find equilibrium had proved futile. The private secretary stood motionless, watching the other man's agony, embarrassed at his intrusion, yet not knowing how to dismiss himself. Eventually the King spoke, in a whisper, but not to the secretary.
"It's no use, David."
The voice was parched and hoarse.
"It cannot be. They will no more let a king be a man than they would any man be king. It cannot be done. You know that, don't you, old friend?"
Then there was silence. The King had not moved, still staring, unseeing, at the screen. The private secretary waited for several seemingly endless seconds and then left, pulling the door gently behind him, as if he were closing the lid on a coffin. Chapter 44.
"I do deference, of course I do. I always raise my kneecap in His Majesty's presence."
Sally rushed across to the House of Commons as soon as she received the summons. She had been in the middle of a pitch to a potential new client, one of the country's leading manufacturers of processed beans, but he had been most understanding, impressed even, and had assured her of the business. With contacts like that, he seemed uninterested in further credentials. A secretary was waiting for her at St. Stephen's entrance, to escort her like a VIP past the long queues of visitors and through the security gates, rushing her past several hundred years of history. It was her first time. One day, she promised herself, she would be back, and take a calmer look at the glories of old England, when she had the patience to queue for several hours with all the rest. But for the moment, she preferred the preferential treatment. They showed her straight into his office. He was on the phone, pacing around the room in his shirt sleeves, trailing the cord of the telephone behind him, animated, issuing orders. "Yes, Brian, I am well, and my wife is well. Thank you very much. Now shut up and listen. This is important. You will be receiving details of a new poll tomorrow afternoon, a telephone poll following the panic in the markets. It will be a startling one. It will show the government in a 10-point lead over the opposition, and my personal lead over McKillen having doubled." He listened for a moment. "Of course it's bloody front-page news. Why on earth do you think I'm giving it to you? That front-page poll will be supported by an editorial inside your newspaper, something along the lines of mortgages and the monarchy. It will blame the problem with sterling and international confidence foursquare on the king and his flawed personality, and those opportunistic politicians who have sought to encourage him in what you will conclude are his grave errors of judgment for seeking to take on the elected government. Are you listening?" There was a mild squawking on the end of the phone, and Urquhart rolled his eyes in impatience. "You are to suggest that their unprincipled support for the king has shattered the opposition and ruined the credibility of McKillen, and even more seriously, has cast the country into a constitutional mess which is causing deep economic anguish. Reluctantly, we'll call for a thoroughgoing review of the monarchy, restricting its powers, its influence, its size, its income. Take it all down carefully. Yes, I've got time." He paused. "Now we come to the important bit, Brian. Pay great attention. Your editorial will finish by concluding that so much economic, political, and constitutional uncertainty has been created that it requires an immediate solution. No time for extended debates, parliamentary commissions of inquiry. Not while every shareholder and mortgage payer in the country is swinging on the hook. The matter needs to be dealt with decisively, once and for all, in the national interest. You are to suggest that the only established means of deciding who governs Britain is to hold an election. Do you understand? An election." He looked across at Sally and winked. "My dear Brian, of course this is something of a shock. That's why I'm giving you the opportunity to prepare. But just between the two of us, until tomorrow. No running down to the bookies to put a couple of quid on an early election now. Another of our little secrets, eh? You call me, only me, Brian, day or night, if you have any questions. Okay? Bye." He turned with an expectant expression towards Sally. She offered back a serious, hard look, almost a scowl. "So who's supposed to be producing this magical overnight poll of yours, Francis?" "Why, you are, my dear. You are." Her bug eyes sank back into their sockets as if trying to hide. It was after midnight, and she had been sitting in front of the computer terminal ever since the last of her staff had departed for the night and left her on her own. She needed space to think. Preparing a questionnaire had been simple, nothing fancy or out of the ordinary. And she had on the shelf any number of computer disks with their random digit dialing facilities, which would give a spin to the sample and so to the results, to drive the survey upmarket or downmarket, give added weight to council house tenants or the substantial leafy glades of suburbia, question only company directors or the unemployed. The trouble was she had no idea how much the sample needed to be lent on to get the desired result. Urquhart was clearly ahead, but by how much? By however much, it would be more after the times had sounded off. There was so much unease and anxiety around. It was a perfect time to hotwire the bandwagon. She wandered around her scruffy premises. The overheads were kept low. All the flash was up front in the reception area. All the quality poured into the strategy and the thinking. The mechanical side was low life. She walked alongside rows of open booths, covered in cloth for soundproofing, where tomorrow the motley collection of part-time staff would gather to sit in front of their individual computer screens, phoning the randomly chosen telephone numbers thrown out by the mainframe, mindlessly reading out the required questions, and equally mindlessly tapping in the answers. They would not suspect. They were junkies in torn jeans, off-duty New Zealand nurses worrying about missed periods, failed businessmen who had suffered from the mistakes of others, and fresh-faced students eagerly waiting to make their own. All that mattered was that they were vaguely computer literate and could turn up at 2 hours' notice. They had no means of knowing what was happening to the information they gathered, and wouldn't care. She paced along the carpet worn with time and well-trodden with gum, examining the polystyrene tiles missing from the corner where the gutter had blocked and backed up, running a finger along the open metal shelves overflowing with computer manuals and telephone directories, and dispatch dockets cast around like sweet wrappers on a windy day. Little natural light penetrated in here to expose the workings of the opinion research industry. She told clients it was for security. In reality, it was simply because the place was a dump. A pot plant had struggled and withered and eventually died, and now doubled as an ashtray. This was her empire. It had its advantages, this air-conditioned, computerized, paperless empire. A few years ago she would have needed to shift a ton of paper to do what she had been asked to do. Now she had to lift no more than a couple of fingers, tap a few keys, the right keys, mind you, and there you had it. Your result, Urquhart's result. But there was the rub. He had been uncompromisingly specific about the figures he wanted, had already given them to Brinford Jones. No matter how much she toyed with the specs or put a wobble into the weighting of the sample, what was required was more than a little spin. She would have to end up doing what she had never done before, and fiddle the result. Take two figures, one government, the other opposition, and work backwards. Not so much massaging as beating them to pulp. If she were found out, she would never work again, might even be put away for criminal deception. To lie, to cheat, to steal the opinions of ordinary men and women and abuse them. For Frances Urquhart, is that what her dreams were all about? She gazed once more around the room, its walls painted black to disguise the cracks, its mustiness which even the lavatory deodorizers couldn't disguise, its tired-out percolators and second-hand furniture, its corners which overflowed with plastic cups and discarded cigarette packets, its fire alarm system, brick red amidst the gloom, a relic of the 1970s, which probably wouldn't work even if tossed into Vesuvius. She picked up the pot plant, plucked off its withered leaves, swept away the stub ends, tidied it as if it were an old and rather disreputable friend. Then she dropped the whole thing, container and all, into the nearest waste bin. This was her empire. And it was no longer enough. Never had been. The lack of sleep showed in Sally's eyes, and she had hidden them behind spectacles with a slight tint, which only served to emphasize the fullness of her mouth and the exceptional animation of her nose. As she walked in through the doorway of Downing Street, one of the doormen nudged a colleague. They had heard talk of her, of course, but this was the first time she had appeared during daylight. And Mortimer Urquhart was at home, too. They smiled at her encouragingly, both wishing they could find some excuse to frisk her for weapons. He was in the cabinet room. It was different from the last occasion they had been here, in the dark, with nothing but the distant glow of street lamps and the tips of their fingers and tongues to guide them. He still sat in his special chair, but this time a civil servant drew back a chair on the opposite side of the table for her. It felt as though she were a million miles away from him. "Good afternoon, Miss Quine." "Prime Minister." She nodded coyly while the civil servant made himself scarce. He waved his arms a little awkwardly. "Excuse the working formality. A busy day." "Your poll, Frances." She opened her briefcase and extracted a single sheet of paper which she thrust across the table. He had to stretch to retrieve it. He studied it briefly. "Of course, I know these are the figures I asked for. But where are the real figures, Sally?" "You are holding them, Frances." "Ludicrous, isn't it? You didn't have to get me to cheat and fiddle. 10 points ahead, just as you asked. You're home and dry." His eyelids blinked rapidly as he took the information in. A smile began, like the fingers of a new dawn creeping across his face. He started nodding in pleasure, as if he had known all along. "I could have kept my innocence after all." He looked up from the piece of paper, a crease across his brow. She was making a point of sorts, but damned if he could figure out what. Over a set of figures,
one poll among the thousands. Selective statistics, the sort of thing government departments did by instinct. He took out a colourful handkerchief and wiped his nose with meticulous, almost exaggerated care. He wanted to celebrate, yet she seemed intent on puncturing his euphoria. That, and the distance between them across the table, would make the next bit easier. "How are the new clients I sent you?" She raised her eyebrows in surprise. It seemed such a tangent. "Fine, really fine. Thanks." "I'm the one who should be grateful, Sally. There will be more in the future. Clients, that is. I want to go on helping." He was looking at the figures again, not at her. He was evidently uncomfortable, unsnapping his watch strap and massaging his wrist, easing his collar as if he felt claustrophobic. Claustrophobic, when she was the only other person in the room. "What is it, Francis?" She pronounced his name in a more nasal manner than usual. Less attractive, he thought. "We have to stop seeing each other." "Why?" "Too many people know." "It never bothered you before?" "Mortimer knows."
"I see."
"And there's the election. It's all very difficult." "It wasn't exactly easy fiddling your goddamn figures." There was a silence. He was still trying to find something in the sheet of paper on which to concentrate. "For how long? How long do we have to stop seeing each other?" He looked up, a flicker of unease in his eyes, his lips stretched awkwardly. "I'm afraid it must be for good. Mortimer insists." "And if Mortimer insists..." Her tone was scornful. "Mortimer and I have a very solid relationship, mature. We understand each other. We don't cheat on that understanding."
"My God, Francis, what the hell do you think we've been doing here, there, everywhere in this building, even in that chair you're sitting in, if it wasn't cheating on your wife? Or wasn't it personal for you, just business?"
He couldn't hold her stare. He began fiddling with his pencil, wondering if she were going to burst into hysterics. Not that, anything but that. He couldn't handle hysterical women.
"Not even after the election, Francis?"
"I've never cheated on her, not like that. Not when she has made her wishes clear."
"But she need never know. Our work together, it's been fantastic, historic."
"And I'm grateful."
"It's been much more than that, Francis. At least for me. You are like none of the other men I've ever been with. I'd hate to lose that. You're better than the rest. You know that, don't you?"
Her nose was bobbing sensuously, full of sexual semaphore, and he felt himself torn. His relationship with Mortimer was his bedrock. Through the years it had made up for his sense of guilt and sexual inadequacy, provided a foundation from which he had withstood all the storms of political ambition and had conquered. It had made him a man. By God, he owed her. She had sacrificed as much as he for his career, in some ways more, but it was all beginning to blur as he stared at Sally. She leant forward, her full breasts enticing, offered up still more fully by the support of the cabinet table.
"I'd be happy to wait, Francis. It would be worth waiting for."
And wasn't she right? He owed Mortimer, but with her it had never been like this. Not raw, uninhibited, dominating lust.
"And there's our work together. We're lucky for each other, Francis. It's got to go on."
He had never betrayed his wife before. Never. But he could feel that irresistible tightness growing within him once more. And somehow Mortimer seemed to belong to another world, the sort of world they had inhabited before he became Prime Minister. Things had changed. The job imposed different rules and responsibilities. He had given Mortimer what she wanted, the chance to run her own court in Downing Street. Did she have a right to ask still more of him? And somehow he knew he would never be able to find another Sally. Would have neither the time nor the opportunity. He might be able to replace her mind, but not her body and what it did for him. She had made him feel so supreme, a young man once again. And he could always explain to Mortimer that it was in nobody's interest to have Sally roaming free, discontented, perhaps vengeful. Not now. "It would be difficult, Sally," he swallowed. "But I'd like to try. First time, give up your innocence, Francis. If you would have it that way." He was staring at her breasts, which held him like a rabbit in the beam of a lamp. She smiled, closed the lid of her briefcase, and snapped the locks shut as if inside it she had trapped his innocence. Then she rose and walked slowly around the long table. She wore a tight black body stocking in an oversized silk cotton jacket from Harvey Nicks, an arrangement he hadn't seen before, and as she approached him the jacket was drawn back to expose her full physical charms. He knew he had made the right decision. It was good for the cause, would ensure continued support and security. Mortimer would understand that, if she ever found out. Sally was there, beside him. She extended a hand. "I can't wait, partner." He stood up. They shook hands. He felt triumphant, all-powerful, as though there were no challenge, no dilemma to which he could not rise. She was a remarkable woman, this American, practically a true British sport, his smile suggested. What an utter English prick, she thought. Chapter 45. No stone unturned, no knife untwisted. Brian Redhead's beard had grown longer and wispier with the years, but his Geordie bite remained formidably sharp. Why else would he have survived so long as the doyen of early morning radio and continued to attract an endless stream of politicians to be mangled and torn even before their first cup of coffee had time to grow cold? He sat in his studio within Broadcasting House like a hermit in his cave, searching for some intangible truth, the table strewn with dirty cups, disused notes, and soiled reputations, glowering at his producer through the murky window of the control room. A huge old-fashioned wall clock with a burnished oak surround hung on the wall, like a British Rail waiting room, the second hand ticking remorselessly onward. "It's time once more for our review of the morning papers, and we have our regular Thursday reviewer Matthew Paris to do just that for us. The royal robes seem to be in something of a twist again, Matthew." "Yes, Brian. Our homebred answer to all those Australian soaps begins another tangle-filled episode this morning, but perhaps there are signs that some sort of ending may be in sight. There are suggestions that we could be losing at least one of the key players, because the latest straw poll carried in the Times puts the opposition 10 points behind, and it could be the straw that breaks the opposition camel's back. Not that Gordon MacKillan will take kindly to being compared to a camel, or a tramp for that matter, but he must be wondering how soon it will be before he's sent off to live in a royal underpass. He might find it a lot more comfortable than the House of Commons this afternoon. But it's the Times editorial comment which has galvanized the rest of Fleet Street in their late editions. Time for an election to clear the air, it asks. No one doubts that it would not only be Mr. MacKillan's leadership under public scrutiny, but also the King's. The Mirror goes back to basics. Under the present system, he could be the biggest twerp in the kingdom yet still get to reign. To use his own words, something has got to be done. And not all the other papers show as much respect. Have you forgotten the Sun headline of just a few days ago, which shouted King of Conscience? The Sun's editor obviously has, because he's reused the same headline today, except it's been abbreviated to read simply King Con. It seems a week is a long time in royal politics. There's more in the rest. In a city office a few miles away from Broadcasting House, Landless switched off the radio. Dawn was still a brushstroke in the sky, but already he was at his desk. His first job had been delivering newspapers as an 8-year-old, running all the way through the dark streets because his parents couldn't afford a bike. stuffing letterboxes and catching glimpses of negligee and bare flesh through the badly drawn curtains. He'd put on a bit of weight since then, and a few millions, but the habit of rising early to catch the others at it had stuck. There was only one other person in the office, the oldest of his three secretaries, who took the early turn. The silence and her greying hair helped him think. He stood lingering over his copy of The Times, laid open on his desk. He read it again, cracking the knuckles of each of his fingers in turn as he tried to figure out what and who lay behind the words. When he had run out of knuckles, he leaned across his desk and tapped the intercom.
"I know it's early, Miss McMahon, and they'll still be pouring the milk over their wholemeal cornflakes and scratching their royal rumps. But see if you can get the palace on the phone."
He had wondered, very briefly and privately, whether he should consult them, take their advice. But only very briefly. As he gazed around the cabinet table at his colleagues, he could find no patience within himself for their endless debates and dithering, their fruitless searches for the easy way ahead, the constant resort to compromise. They had all arrived with their red cabinet folders containing the formal cabinet papers, and the notes which civil servants felt might be necessary to support their individual positions or gently undermine those of rival colleagues. Colleagues. It was only his leadership, his authority, which prevented them from indulging in the sort of petty squabbles that would disgrace a kindergarten. Anyway, the civil servants' notes were irrelevant, because the civil servants had not known that he was about to hijack the agenda. There had been no point in seeking opinions. They would have been so pathetically predictable. Too soon, too precipitate, too uncertain, too much damage to the institution of the monarchy, they would have said. Too much chance they would lose their ministerial chauffeurs sooner than necessary. Oh, ye of little faith. They needed some backbone, some spunk. They needed terrifying out of their political wits. He had waited until they finished smiling and congratulating each other at their favourable showing in the opinion polls. Their favourable showing. He had called on the Chancellor of the Exchequer to recite for them just how wretched it was all going to be, particularly after the chaos in the markets had knocked the stuffing out of business confidence. A tunnel which had been dug deeper and longer than anyone could have expected, the Chancellor recited, with not a flicker of light to be seen, and a budget in the middle of next month which would blow holes in their socks, if they had any socks left. While they were chewing nauseously on these bones, he had asked the employment secretary about the figures. School holidays beginning on the 15th of March, some 300,000 school leavers flooding onto the market, and employment prospects which looked as welcoming as a witch's armpit. The jobless total would rise above 2 million. Another election pledge out of the window. And then he had turned to the Attorney General's report about the prospect for Sir Jasper Harrod's trial. From the ague which crossed one or two of the faces, he suspected there were other individual donations which had not yet come to light amongst the high and, for the moment, mighty. Thursday, the 28th of March, was the trial date. No postponements likely. The dirty linen being hung out to dry within days of the first rap of the judge's gavel. Sir Jasper had made it clear he did not wish to suffer on his own. The colleagues had begun to look as though they were sailing in an overcrowded dinghy through a Force 9 before he put his own twist to their discomfort. A strong rumour that McKillen was considering resignation at Easter. Only that twerp of an Environment Secretary Dickey thought it good news. The rest had recognised it immediately for what it was, the opposition's best hope of salvation, a new start. A clean break with McKillen's fooleries and failures, a leap for firm new ground. Even the other dunderheads had seen that, all except Dickie. He would have to go after the election. Only after silence had hung in the air for many seconds did he throw them a lifeline, a chance to be hauled towards dry land. An election. On Thursday, the 14th of March. Just enough time if they hurried and scuttled to tidy up the parliamentary loose ends and a dissolution which would squeeze them through before the next storms hit and overwhelmed them. Not a suggestion, not a request for opinions, simply an indication of his mastery of tactics and why he was Prime Minister and not any of the rest of them. A strong opinion poll lead, an opposition in disarray, a royal scapegoat, a timetable—
and an audience with the king in under an hour to issue the royal proclamation. What more could they want? Yes, he knew it was tight, but there was time enough. Just.
Chapter 46. Those who wish to cross a king must find themselves a sound horse.
Your Majesty.
Urquhart. They did not bother sitting. The king showed no signs of offering a chair, and Urquhart needed only seconds to deliver his message.
There is only one piece of business I wish to raise. I want an immediate election for the 14th of March.
The king stared at him, but said nothing.
I suppose, in fairness, I must tell you that part of the government's manifesto will be a proposal to establish a parliamentary committee of inquiry into the monarchy, its duties and responsibilities. I shall propose to that commission a series of radical restrictions on the activities, role, and financing of both you and your relatives. There has been too much scandal and confusion. It is time for the people to decide.
When he replied, the king's voice was remarkably soft and controlled.
It never ceases to amaze me how politicians can always pontificate in the name of the people, even as they utter the most absurd falsehoods. Yet if I, an hereditary monarch, were to read from the testaments, my words would still be regarded with suspicion.
The insult was delivered slowly, so that it sank deep. Urquhart smiled patronizingly, but offered no response.
So it is to be outright war, is it? You and me, the king and his Cromwell. Whatever happened to that ancient English virtue of compromise?
I am a Scot.
So you would destroy me, and with me the constitution which has served this country so well for generations.
A constitutional monarchy is built on the mistaken concept of dignity and perfect breeding. It is scarcely my fault that you have all turned out to have the appetites and sexual preferences of goats. The king flinched as if he had been slapped, and Urquhart realized he may have gone a step too far. After all, what was the point?
I will bother you no longer, sir. I merely came to inform you of the dissolution. 14th of March.
So you say, but I don't think you shall have it.
There was no alarm in Urquhart's demeanour. He knew his rights.
What nonsense is this?
You expect me to issue a royal proclamation today, this instant?
As I have every right to do.
Possibly. And then again, possibly not. An interesting point, don't you think? Because I also have rights accorded by the same constitutional precedents. Rights to be consulted, to advise, and to warn.
I am consulting you. Give me as much advice as you want. Warn me, threaten me, for all I care. But that cannot prevent you from granting the dissolution I demand. That is the right of the Prime Minister.
Be reasonable, Prime Minister. This is my first time at this. I am new to the job. I need to take advice myself. Talk to a few people, make sure I am taking the correct constitutional action. I'm sure I could be in a position to grant your request by, say, next week. It's not unreasonable, is it? Just a few days?
That cannot be.
And why not?
You cannot expect me to hold an election on Maundy Thursday, when those who are not on their knees are flat on their backs for the Easter holidays. No delay. I will not have it. Do you hear?
The composure had been peeled away. Urquhart's fists were clenched in consternation, and his legs braced as if he were about to launch a direct physical attack against the monarch. Instead of flinching or drawing back, the king began to laugh, a frosty, hollow noise which echoed around the high ceiling.
"You must forgive me, Urquhart, my little joke. Of course I cannot delay your demand. I merely wanted to see how you would react."
The muscles continued to pull his face into the expression of a smile, but behind it there was no sense of warmth. The eyes were like frost.
"You seem to be in something of a hurry. And so, I have to tell you, am I. For your eagerness has helped prompt a decision of my own. You see, Urquhart, I despise you, and all that you stand for. The ruthless, relentless, utterly soulless way you pursue your ends. I feel bound to do everything within my power to stop you.
Urquhart was shaking his head. But you cannot delay an election.
No, but neither can I accept what I know to be a fact, that you have destroyed my friends and my family, and now you attempt to destroy me, and along with me, the crown. You know, Charlotte may be a foolish woman, but she is basically a kind soul. She didn't deserve what you did to her. But then neither did Mycroft.
He waited for a second or two.
I see you don't even feel the need to deny it.
I make no comment. You can prove nothing.
I don't need to. Only to myself, at least. You see, Urquhart, you have used those I love as a doormat on which to wipe your boots as you wade your way through the sewers. Now you wish to trample on me. I won't allow it.
There's nothing you can do. After this election, the Crown will never be in a position to play politics again.
On that, Prime Minister, we are agreed. It's taken me much anguish to face up to the fact that what I've been doing these last months, the ideals I've been trying to cherish, the interests I wish to propagate, are politics. Sadly, there is no clear dividing line anymore. If I hold a view in public, even about the weather, then it is politics.
At last we are making progress.
I am. I'm not so sure about you. I have a duty, a divine duty almost, to do everything within my powers to protect the crown. I have an equally strong commitment to myself and those things in which I believe. But conscience sits uneasily beneath a modern crown. You have made certain of that.
The people will make certain of that.
Perhaps, but not on the 14th of March.
Urquhart wiped a hand across his mouth in exasperation. You are wearing my patience thin. It shall be the 14th of March.
But it cannot be, because you must delay the dissolution of Parliament for an unexpected piece of business.
What business?
For a bill of abdication.
Another of your silly jokes.
I am not noted for my sense of humour.
You will abdicate. For the first time, Urquhart began to feel he was losing his grip. His jaw betrayed the slightest quiver.
In order to protect the crown and my conscience, and in order to fight you and your kind by every means possible, it is the only way.
There was no mistaking the earnestness that had always been the man's weakness, a complete inability to hide his honesty. Urquhart's eyes flickered rapidly as he tried to calculate the political fallout and how much damage any delay might inflict on his plans. He would still win, surely. The People's Parliament before the Crown. He would have to squeeze another week's grace out of the calendar, even if it meant Maundy Thursday, a propitious day for giving kings their comeuppance. Unless... My God, he wasn't going to replace MacKillan as leader of the opposition, was he? No, it was too ludicrous.
What role do you expect to play in the campaign?
The words were hesitant.
A modest one. Highlighting the issues of concern to me, of poverty, the lack of opportunities for the young, urban and environmental squalor. I shall ask David Mycroft for his help. He has a flair for publicity, don't you think?
The king had changed. The habitual tension in his face seemed to have eased, grown softer, no longer plagued by nightmares and self-inflicted guilt. He seemed almost to be enjoying himself.
But whatever I shall do shall be done entirely properly. I will not engage in personal confrontation or debate with you, although others, I suspect, will be less fastidious.
He moved to a button hidden behind one of the window drapes and pushed it. Almost immediately the door opened, and in walked Benjamin Landless.
You, May,
He nodded. It's been a long time, Francis. Seems like a lifetime ago. Almost a different world.
Bizarre bedfellows. A king and a low-born thug like you.
Needs must.
I suppose you intend to publish and promote the Royal Witterings.
Possibly, Francis, but not to the exclusion of other important news.
For the first time, Urquhart noticed that Landless held something in his hand. A clutch of papers.
Photos, Francis. You know about photos, don't you?
Landless held them out towards Urquhart, who took them as though offered a goblet of hemlock. He studied them in complete silence, unable to engage his tongue, even if he had found the words.
There seems to have been an outbreak of this sort of thing recently, don't you think, sir?
Landless offered.
Regrettably, the king responded.
Francis, you'll recognize your wife, of course. The other person, the one underneath, sorry, on top in the one you're looking at now, is an Italian. Possibly you've met him, sings or some such nonsense, and doesn't draw his curtains properly.
Urquhart's hands were trembling such that the photographs were in danger of falling from his grasp. With an angry cry, he crushed them within his fist and hurled them across the room.
I'll disown her. People will understand, sympathize. That's not politics.
The king could not restrain his snort of contempt.
I sincerely hope you're right, Frankie, Landless continued, but I have my doubts. People will find it very lumpy porridge when they find out about your own outside interests.
Meaning? A haunted edge was creeping into Urquhart's eyes.
Meaning a particular young and very attractive lady who has not only been seen a lot in Downing Street since you got there, but who has also recently made a huge killing on the foreign exchanges. Anyone might think she knew something or someone on the inside. Or will you try to disown her too?
The cheeks were suddenly drained, the words tumbling between trembling lips.
How on earth? You couldn't possibly know.
A huge, bear-like arm was placed around Urquhart's shoulders, and Landless lowered his voice to a conspiratorial whisper. As if on cue, the king walked over to a window and turned his back on them, preoccupying himself with the view of his garden.
Let you in on a little secret, old chum. You see, she's been my partner as well as yours. I have to thank you. Did very nicely out of the currency wobbles, switched out of sterling just in time.
This isn't necessary, he gasped, bewildered. You could have done just as well with me.
Landless looked the other man carefully up and down.
No, afraid you're not my type, Francis.
Why, Ben? Why are you doing this to me?
How many reasons do you want?
He raised his hand to count off the pudgy fingers.
Because you so obviously enjoyed treating me like shit. Because prime ministers come and go, as you'll soon be gone, while the royal family endures.
He nodded his huge head in the direction of the king's back.
And perhaps mostly because he welcomed me just as I am, Big Bad Benjamin from Bethnal Green, without looking down his nose, when I was never good enough for you or your high and mighty wife.
He twisted over his hand so that it became an upturned claw.
So I'm squeezing your balls as hard as I can.
Why? Oh, why?
Urquhart continued to moan. Landless's fist closed tight.
Because they're there, Francis. Because they're there.
He chuckled.
Talking of which, I have good news of Sally.
Urquhart could only raise mournful eyes in inquiry.
She's pregnant.
Not by me, Urquhart gasped.
No, not by you.
The voice, which had patronized, now sneered.
Seems you're not man enough for anything.
So he knew about that, too. Urquhart turned away from his antagonist, trying to hide the humiliation, but Landless was in full pursuit.
She's played you for the fool you are, Frankie, in politics and in bed, or wherever it was. You shouldn't have used her. All that brains and beauty, and you threw it away.
Urquhart was shaking his head, like a dog trying to rid itself of an unwanted collar.
She's got new business, new clients, new capital, and a new man. It's a different life for her, Frankie. And being pregnant, too. Well, you know what women are like about things like that. Or rather, you don't, but take it from me. She's an exceptional and very happy lady.
Who did she...
He seemed unable to finish.
Who did she prefer to you?
Landless chuckled.
You idiot. You still can't see it, can you?
Urquhart's whole body had shrunk. His shoulders sagged and his mouth gaped open. He couldn't, wouldn't take it in. A look of triumph suffused the publisher's rubbery face.
I'll beat you at everything, Frankie. Even with Sally.
Urquhart had an overwhelming, primal desire to crawl away, to find a dark place, any place, to bury his humiliation as quickly and as deeply as he could manage. But he couldn't depart. Not yet. There was one more thing he had to do first. A final chance, perhaps, to buy a little time. He made an attempt at straightening his shoulders and walked stiffly across the room until he was facing the king's back. His face was contorted with the effort, and he drew a deep, gulping breath.
"Sir, I have changed my mind. I withdraw my request for a dissolution."
The king spun round on his heel like an officer on parade.
"Oh, do you, Prime Minister? Damn difficult, that. I've already set the wheels in motion, you see. Prime Minister's right to demand an election. Of course, the Constitution's clear about that. Can't for the life of me remember the bit where it says he's allowed to call one off. Anyway, I'm the one who dissolves Parliament and signs the royal proclamation, and that's just what I'm going to do. If you find my actions objectionable on constitutional or personal grounds, I'm sure I can rely on your vote during the abdication debate."
"I shall withdraw my proposals for constitutional reform," Urquhart uttered in exhaustion. "If necessary, I shall make a public apology for any misunderstanding."
"Decent of you to offer, Urquhart. Saves me and Mr. Landless here insisting on it. I would like the apology made when you introduce the abdication bill."
"But there's no need. You win. We can turn the clock back."
"You still don't understand, do you? I am going to abdicate, whether you want that or not. I'm not the right man for this task I was born to. I don't have the self-restraint required of a king. I've come to terms with that. My abdication will protect the crown and all it stands for, much more effectively than if I try to muddle my impatient way through the murky constitutional waters. My son has already been sent for, and the Regency papers are being drawn up. He is more patient than I, younger, more flexible. He will have a better chance of growing into the great king I shall never be."
He prodded his own chest.
"It's the best thing for me, the man."
The finger turned on Urquhart.
"And it's also the best damned way I can devise of destroying you and everything you stand for."
Urquhart's lip trembled.
"You used to be an idealist. And you, Mr. Urquhart, used to be a politician."
Epilogue. There was a knock on the front door, a soft, tentative sort of rapping. Kenny put down his book and went to answer it. The door opened, and there on the darkened doorway, wrapped in a new overcoat against the blustery rain, stood Mycroft. Mycroft had prepared his explanations and apologies carefully. With the announcement of the abdication and election, things had changed. The press had new fish to gut and fry, and would leave them alone if Kenny could understand and forgive. But as he looked up at the other man, he could see the pain deep within the startled eyes, and his words deserted him. They stood facing each other, each afraid of what the other might say, not wanting to expose once again the scarcely healed wounds. It seemed to Mycroft several lifetimes before Kenny finally spoke.
Are you going to stand out there all sodding night, David? The bear's tea will be getting cold.